This is Living Lab on The Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, recently released a new report on the state of climate science. The conclusion? The evidence for climate change is unequivocal. Glaciers are melting, sea level is rising, heat waves, storms, and other extreme weather events are becoming more common. And the IPCC now says it's 95 to 100% certain that human activities are the primary cause. The vast majority, an estimated 97% or more, of climate scientists are in agreement on this point, but the American public remains ambivalent. Only about half of Americans are convinced that climate change is happening and is largely caused by human activities. So why the difference? There have been a variety of explanations over the years: propaganda campaigns, poor media coverage, scientists failing to explain their research clearly. But it turns out there may be a deeper explanation. Psychology and social science increasingly suggest that the human brain may be hardwired to reject scientific fact if it threatens our worldview and deeply held beliefs. Research also shows that targeted communication strategies can overcome these obstacles. Joining me now to discuss the science of denial is Dr. Anthony Lacerowitz. He's a research scientist and director of the Yale Project on Climate Change at the School of Forestry and Environmental Studies at Yale University. Also, Lynn Cherry, renowned children's book author and illustrator, and founder of Young Voices for the Planet, a series of short videos highlighting kids who have taken action to address climate change. Welcome to both of you.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, great to be with you.
Now, Anthony, let's start. What do we know about why the American public is so hesitant to accept the scientific consensus on climate change? Is this just a matter of a lack of understanding, or what else is going on?
Well, this is a longstanding issue, and so there's a variety of different levels of this. So you started off by talking about some of the psychological components of this. So let's start with that. Now, this is an issue that's actually hard for most of us to get our heads around. We're talking about invisible greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide. So any of us can look out the window right this moment, and there's CO2 pouring out of smokestacks, out of tailpipes, out of buildings. In fact, there's CO2 coming out of your mouth and nose right this very moment. And probably until I mentioned it, you hadn't even been conscious of that. And that's because carbon dioxide, the primary cause of climate change, is invisible. And likewise, many of the impacts are invisible unless we know where to look. And so as a result, this is hard for most people to immediately see. It's not like when the Cuyahoga River caught on fire and people could immediately see in a very visceral way, oh, we've got a problem. So one is that, you know, we just perceptually aren't well suited to be able to recognize these kinds of threats. But then it's also a global threat. It's not just localized. So before, when there was, say, acid rain or pollution coming out of a single smokestack, you could see that you could see it. You could see the effects immediately. Now we're talking about a global problem where these invisible gases very quickly diffuse through the Earth's atmosphere and basically end up scattered across the entire atmosphere very quickly. So in this sense, it's a problem for all of us. It's not just a single localized issue.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, you're talking about the impacts and those being more or less invisible. But over the past few years, we've had extreme weather events. We've had heat waves. We've had severe storms. And we've seen through the Yale Six Americas study, this ongoing study of American public opinion about climate change, that opinions about climate change fluctuate around that. I mean, we have a cold winter and acceptance of climate change as a reality goes down. We have a hot summer. It goes back up. How fickle is the human brain in terms of actually accepting this as a reality?
Well, there's a lot of other things going on there. So first of all, back to your point about how people react to changing temperature. So first of all, let me just back up and quickly describe the Six Americas, because I think it's a really useful frame for this. So we've identified that there isn't just a single human response or American response. In fact, there are six very different audiences in the American public that each respond quite differently. First is a group we call the alarm. This is about 16% of American public. They are convinced it's happening, human-caused, a serious and urgent problem, and they want to know, what can I do? What can we collectively do? Secondly is a group we call the concerned. This is about 26% of the American public. They think it's happening, it's human-caused, it's serious, but they think it's distant. Distant in time, that the impacts won't be felt for a generation or more, and distant in space. This is about polar bears, small island countries, not the United States, not my community, not my friends and family. So yeah, I wish somebody would do something about it, but it's seen as a distant problem. Then a group we call the cautious, it's another quarter of the public, basically still on the fence, still trying to make up their mind. Is it happening? Is it not? Is it human? Is it natural? Is it serious? Is it kind of overblown? Paying attention, but haven't made up their mind. Then a very small group, 5%, we call the disengaged. They've heard the term global warming but don't know anything about it. Then a group we call the doubtful. This is 15% of the country. These are people who say, I don't think it's happening. But if it is, it's natural. Nothing humans had anything to do with. Nothing we can do anything about. Therefore, they don't pay that much attention, but they don't see it as a risk. And then last but not least is a group we call the dismissive. And that's 13% of the country as of our last national survey in April. These are people who are firmly convinced it's not happening, it's not human-caused, it's not a serious threat. And many are what we would lovingly call conspiracy theorists. They say it's a hoax, it's scientists making up data, it's a UN plot to take away American sovereignty, it's Al Gore and his friends trying to get rich, and many, many other such variants. So these are these wide range and spectrum of different starting points that people have in this country when they come to this issue. So now I can come back to your question about what happens when there's a warm spell or a cold spell. The two groups on the end, the alarmed and the dismissive, are deeply committed to their current position. They're emotionally invested in either believing firmly that climate change is real or denying it. They are not going to change their views when they suddenly experience either a warm spell or a cold spell. Instead, they engage in what we call motivated reasoning. They look for real-world evidence that seems to validate and reinforce what they believe, even when sometimes that's not appropriate. So I'll take two examples. The alarmed, sometimes when there's a big tornado disaster, will say, aha, look, there's global warming. Actually, there is no well-known scientific link between climate change and tornadoes, at least not yet. So that's not an appropriate connection to make. On the other hand, when there's a big massive snowstorm like Snowstorm Nemo that happened last winter, some of the dismissives will say, aha, look, where's your global warming? Big snow, that doesn't seem like global warming. Well, actually, snowstorms are entirely consistent with climate change. But nonetheless, they will use that real-world experience to try to justify and bolster their own view. But it's the groups in the middle, the roughly 70% of the public, who don't know much about the issue, who haven't yet really made up their mind about it, that are the most likely to be influenced by either a hot spell or a cold spell, because they will draw on their own personal experience. We are basically animals in the end, and use that to try to assess for themselves, is it happening or not? And that's where you see public opinion as a whole sloshing back and forth a little bit as those kinds of hot and cold spells take place.
Now, Lynn Cherry, coming from your experience, long experience working with kids, do kids constitute kind of a seventh America? I mean, this Six America study that we were talking about is only adults. Are they kind of a unified seventh America with one way of responding to climate change, or do you see this whole spectrum of responses to climate change or environmental challenges in kids as well?
That's really interesting. I haven't seen the spectrum because I'm talking to kids. I'm showing them these films, Young Voices for the Planet, where they're really focusing on success stories. We're focusing on kids who are planting trees and getting rid of plastic bags and saving these birds from oil spills. And so we're sort of doing an end run around the six Americas in that we're focused more on action. And so when kids, these are just win-win projects, you know. So for instance, when I was doing mostly children's books and I would go speak to kids about the destruction of the Amazon or the river that was all polluted, or polar bears, they would cry. I mean, they would actually get upset.
I mean, these are scary things.
They were scary things, yes. But I soon realized that because there were other kids who would come up to me and say, but look, you know, we just saved this forest, or, you know, we just cleaned up our local lake. And so I started taking these success stories. And whenever I would talk about anything that was maybe just a little disturbing about, you know, environmental issues, I would always pair them with the success stories of, look what kids have done. Kids have power. Kids can make a difference. It made all the difference in the world if I integrated those stories, and especially if I started with those stories. If I said, first, look what kids can do. Kids have power. I'm going to show you some troubling things, but I want you to know you can make a difference. And then it was all palatable to them.
Well, and that actually echoes what we've been learning in the kind of the psychological and social science that's been going on in the past few years. There was one study in 2010 from UC Berkeley that showed that if you gave an audience a very dire message, they tended to reject it. If you gave them a dire message, but you paired it with a very hopeful message of action, people were much more likely to accept it. And I think that kind of goes back, Anthony Lasarowicz, to some of what you were talking about in terms of, you know, when we can accept and not accept this, the motivated reasoning, when you have a really vested interest in it, and it, sometimes it's very hard to accept the facts that conflict with the values that you do hold.
Sure, but that's again only for those that that relative few proportion of the public that have deeply ideological response to this issue. Many other people, however, come back to this key question of threat. So one is that clearly we respond to threat. I mean, biologically, through evolution, we have developed an incredibly sensitive ability to recognize immediate threat. And fear is one of our most powerful motivators to get us to actually take action. It's not enough to just know something mentally or cognitively, but you need to feel something emotionally that is what will motivate you to do things. But we also know from an incredible amount of research is that just having a sense of threat is not enough. That has to be paired with a sense of what we call efficacy, that you have to understand that there are things that you can do or collectively that we can do, and that if we do them, it will make a difference. If you don't have that sense that there is hope, essentially, then people's natural reaction is to say, well, then I can't do anything about this threat. Therefore, I'm not going to pay attention to it because it's why would I go into a scary place where I have no control and I can't do anything about it? Mm-hmm. So I think Lynn is exactly right. What she learned through trial and error is exactly what the social science literature shows us through many studies, is that it's crucial to give people both a clear sense of what's really at stake, but at the same time empower them with the understanding that this is in fact solvable.
Now, of course, when you talk about feeling threatened, that depends on what you hold valuable, what might be threatened, right? And whether or not you find certain solutions palatable also would then depend on your personally held values. And there's a term that your colleagues and you at Yale have coined for this called cultural cognition. So can you explain a little bit about what cultural cognition is?
Sure. This is just recognizing that, you know, scientific information does not automatically translate into, you know, changes in people's perceptions of risk or behavior. That scientific information always drops into a very rich and complex cultural and social landscape that is riven by different values. And one of the things in particular that I and my colleagues here at Yale have seen over and over is that one of the strongest predictors of how people respond to the issue of climate change is one's deeper cultural worldview. In particular, people that have a strong, what we call egalitarian set of values, people who care about things like affirmative action and eradicating poverty, and that there are far too great of wealth inequities in the world and so on. These people, even though those are not about climate change or even the environment per se, they care much more about climate change. But by contrast, people who have a deeply what we call individualistic worldview, which often is expressed as an anti-government kind of an attitude of the government's too big, it's too intrusive, it's taking away our individual liberties, anti-regulation, anti-tax, perhaps most best and today very styled as the Tea Party or hardcore libertarian viewpoint, those people are the most hostile to the issue of climate change.
Well,
and so
in fact,
these values.
Yeah, we've seen that essentially become entrenched as part of the conservative Republican political platform at this point, essentially, is the denial of climate change or human-caused climate change.
That's right. And what's important to recognize is that dismissive group I described earlier, who tend to have very strong individualistic values, they're also afraid of climate change. So the alarmed are afraid of climate change because they're afraid of the impacts of climate change. The dismissive are also afraid of climate change. But what they're afraid of is that it's going to require government solutions. And that's what they're really afraid of. And in that sense, climate change is just another front in a much bigger political and cultural struggle in this country, which we're seeing play out in Washington, D.C. right this very moment over the Affordable Care Act and Obamacare. They see climate change as yet another attempt to make the government bigger and more intrusive, just like Obamacare, just like the deficit, just like budgets, and so on. So this really is part of that broader cultural debate.
Lynn Cherry, you're nodding your head.
Yeah, I agree totally. And this whole issue of You mentioned efficacy. Well, Albert Bandura wrote about self-efficacy and about how that's when kids feel that they have the ability to change their world or change your life personally or change the world at large, then they're going to be more willing to accept a lot of troubling things because they feel that they have control. And so I think that Heather had asked about my finding with these young people that they are one of the six Americas. And I think the reason that they're not is because they are developing this ability in their own belief that they can make change. And so when they understand that they have the power to make change, then that fear is not an issue. And it reminds me of this Journal of Personality and Social Psychology article in Motivated Avoidance. And while people are motivated to avoid something that they really fear and feel that they have no power to change, but that when they feel that they can change it, then they're no longer motivated to avoid it. So I totally agree with everything Tony's saying.
So were you aware of this kind of research when you started writing about climate change?
No, it's really interesting. I wrote the book with Gary Brosh, How We Know What We Know About Our Changing Climate, Scientists and Kids Explore Global Warming. And the idea was, like the scientists that I know quite well, that just by telling the science, if everyone knew the science, that they would all be motivated to do something about climate change. That's what we all thought. But it turned out not to be the case. And this motivated avoidance study actually showed that the more science you throw at people, the harder they run away. The more motivated they are to avoid it if they see it as intractable, troubling, that they don't have any power to change it. So to answer your question, when I first started out with this book, we had the solutions because of my experience with the kids, teaching them about environmental issues. And we found the solutions were the most popular part of the book, about how you reduce CO2. And the teachers would come back to me and say, this should be at the front of the book. We need to be telling about the solutions beforehand. So then when I decided to morph the project into making films, then I decided that the thrust of these films was going to be the kids' solutions, planting trees, reducing CO2, all the things that they could do, and that it was going to talk about climate change, but it was mostly focused on the actions they could take to make a difference. And as a result, they're very powerful.
We'll talk more about Lynn's video series, Young Voices for the Planet, after a short break.
Another Science Minute.
Believe it or not, many plants and animals that live in the ocean, you can think of them as like last pick in gym class.
Environmental chemist Chris Reddy of the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution.
And if they have no hard shell, they don't move fast, they have no other mechanism to defend themselves, they likely make chemicals to defend themselves. Some of these chemicals that are made by sponges and other plants and animals in the ocean have incredible similar properties and almost look exactly like DDT and flame retardants and all these chemicals. I mean, spooky how close they are in their composition. To look at a structure made naturally and then look at something that DuPont made millions and millions of dollars and say they're almost the same. Nature trumped you. Nature was way ahead of you guys, and they never got to pull a patent.
You're listening to WCAI, the Cape and Islands NPR station.
Next time on The World, you're going to love this guy, Karl Remarks. He pokes fun at Middle East politics, and he tweets jokes in English and Arabic.
Yeah, a lot of the Arabic readers are completely brutal because this is so absurd. Why did you even waste your time writing this? Which is brilliant. I love getting these comments because there's complete honesty.
Meet Karl Remarks next time on The World. Tonight at 8 on WCAI, the Cape and Islands NPR station.
Welcome back to Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. We're talking this hour about the science of denial, why we sometimes find it difficult to accept scientific facts, and how certain communication strategies can overcome the psychological obstacles. My guests are Dr. Anthony Lucerowicz, director of the Yale Project on Climate Change, and author and producer Lynn Cherry. So, Lynn, before the break, we were talking about you kind of making this switch. First of all, learning that solutions need to come first when you're talking to kids about climate change. And then making the switch from writing books and illustrating books, which is what you had been doing for years, to making videos. So what prompted that switch?
I realized that kids have power And as I was doing my kids' books, like, for instance, you know, ones about the rainforest, a great kapok tree, a river ran wild, about cleaning up a river. And when the kids would read these stories, they would say, I want to save an acre in the rainforest. I want to clean up our local river. So they were very motivated. And then I began to collect stories of kids who were going out and cleaning up their rivers and saving large tracts of land. And so it was very empowering for other kids to see those stories. And I realized that I had to do the same thing with climate change, that if I was telling stories, success stories of kids doing something about climate change, it would motivate other kids to do the same. And that actually has been the case. I'd love to share the story with you.
Go ahead. Okay. Yes.
I showed the stories to an 11-year-old. It was a group of 11-year-olds in Massachusetts. And this 11-year-old girl came up afterwards. She was so excited. And she said, we have to do something. We have to do something. I'm going to start a club. We're going to call it Saving Tomorrow.
And what a great name.
Yeah. And so about a month later, her father sent me a video. And Saving Tomorrow, this group of kids, had gone to the Lexington Town Hall where they were debating whether or not to overturn this regulation that didn't allow solar panels on the roofs of town buildings. And so Alice got up and said, we don't think they're unsightly. We think they're beautiful. To us, they mean that we're not going to have climate change, that we're going to reduce CO2 emissions. And another kid got up and said, do you love us? If you love your kids, if you care about our future, you will let us put these, you know, you will put these solar panels on the roofs. And they got a standing ovation and they changed the regulations. So I have lots of stories like this, how the movies have motivated kids to go out and do real-world things that have really serious significance in reducing CO2 emissions.
Well, Anthony Osarowitz, those two comments that Lynn was just recounting seemed to play exactly to what we were talking about in terms of the deeply held values, you know, the difference between seeing solar panels as unsightly if you're used to over a lifetime seeing shingles on a roof instead of solar panels, and also this idea of loving your children or caring for your children, you know, how that fits into this as well.
Yeah, and in fact, I think this is why kids are so important. So we've actually done studies with teenage kids. We haven't gone below 13 years old. But we've been very interested at looking at internal family dynamics. In other words, asking parents and their kids who starts the conversation, who knows more about climate change, who shares more information, who learns more, et cetera. And what we find is that, yes, parents do influence kids. So thankfully, that's still true for those of us who are parents. But kids do influence parents as well. And when we look at the arrows of causality, it appears that kids actually often have a greater influence on their parents than vice versa. And so, you know, when kids get empowered and get excited and feel like, yes, there is something I can do, you know, these great stories of going to a town hall meeting and, you know, changing policy are fantastic. But the other thing that kids do really that's really important is that they bring these ideas and these concerns back home around the kitchen table. Mm-hmm. And they challenge their parents. They challenge their friends. They challenge their grandparents and extended family members to say, why do we act the way we do? And I think kids have had a tremendous impact on adults. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, kids are really important messengers.
I mean, I remember actually myself as a kid. I don't know if I was 10 or 12 years old and, you know, late elementary school or middle school. And we talked about recycling at school. And I just remember coming home to my mom with that kind of energy and enthusiasm and naivety that children have and go, we have to recycle. Why are we not recycling? We have to recycle. And my mom kind of pushing back and saying, well, we don't recycle because it's hard or there's no recycling pickup or, you know, all these kinds of things that would occur to an adult that just don't even occur to or matter to a child. And I kept pushing and said, well, it doesn't matter. We have to recycle. Mm-hmm. And you're saying that kind of thing, you know, happens a lot.
Yeah. A League of Conservation Voters study showed that most people get their environmental information from materials that their kids bring home from school and that their kids are the most important influence on them.
I don't know if we should find this inspiring or scary.
Than the most important influence them to lead a sustainable lifestyle.
Well, I want to give everybody a sense of what some of these videos from the Young Voices for the Planet series sound like. And one of them actually was based in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, where a group of kids decided to try to reduce the carbon footprint of their school and of their community by introducing local food into the school cafeteria. We've posted the video on our website, so you can watch it. But I want to play a couple of clips here. In particular, I want to have everybody hear how that video begins.
I've always enjoyed living in the Berkshires because I find it to be a very unique, close-knit place to live. We have a very extensive vegetable garden. We've been getting beef and pork from a local farmer, and we get our own eggs from our chickens. So in eighth grade, a year ago, I saw what the high school students were doing with this food initiative, and I thought it was fantastic. And I just knew I wanted to become a part of it the second I got into high school.
I mean, you've got wonderful music there, the sounds of the chickens. In the video, there's this beautiful scenery from the Berkshires and this very articulate young woman speaking to you. Not a single mention of global warming or climate change or any scary threat anywhere in that.
No, because initially they came at this because their food in their school cafeteria was subpar, and they wanted to have better food in their school cafeteria. Then once they started investigating, they realized all the implications of this bad food. About, you know, an apple that came from locally was 61 food miles, and one that came from their, you know, their supplier was over 1,000, and how much carbon that meant.
Well, and so about 4 minutes into this 10-minute video, finally, we get around to an explanation of how this project does impact climate change or turns into climate action. But still, it's not anything that seems terribly scary.
Shipping this food all around the world to get it into our cafeteria creates a huge amount of CO2, a main contributor to global warming. So for example, locally grown apples travel 61 miles, whereas conventionally sourced apples travel 1,726 miles. So you can see how much carbon that's really creating, because it's a lot of carbon. We all really care about decreasing our carbon footprint because we live in such a beautiful place and we want to preserve that.
I mean, again, it's very upbeat, even as you're talking about this carbon footprint, some math thrown in there, a potentially kind of overwhelming problem, it seems like, but it doesn't feel like that at all when you hear it in this setting.
No, it's just, here's a problem, we can solve it, and by the way, we're going to do something about global climate change.
Now, Anthony Lacerowitz, I want to ask you, in addition to doing your research on public opinion about climate change, you are a photographer. On your website, you have a number of galleries of your kind of nature and other photography. And you've actually done some research about what kinds of imagery might be effective in conveying the challenges of climate change. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, so I think let's back up and just recognize that as human beings, we are incredibly visual. Far more of our brain's real estate is dedicated to processing our vision than any of our other senses. I mean, we are primarily visual beings. And so the images that we see in relation to climate change often have a huge influence on us. So actually, I can't see any of our audience, but let me just give you an example of the kind of thing that we do in our studies. So this is a question I ask of the American public every time we do a survey, and it's very simple. It's farmer-free association. What's the first thought or image that comes to mind when you hear the term global warming? Now, I will guarantee that many, many people who just heard me ask that question immediately had something come into their mind about melting ice. Sea ice retreating on the Arctic Ocean, ice shells breaking off Antarctica, before and after pictures of glaciers melting around the world. And that turns out to be very, very common. It's one of the most common immediate images that comes to most people's minds. And on the one hand, that's a really useful thing. It's also one of the things that the media has tended to emphasize. So we've done studies, for example, of how the media actually puts a photograph on a climate change story. And all too often, it's a picture of a melting glacier.
Well, and so is that because what people associate with it? Or do people associate that with climate change because what they've seen? I mean, it's this very circular thing, I guess.
It is a very circular thing, absolutely. But it also has become part of this. So first of all, it's a useful set of pictures because it helps and it resonates with something we all understand intuitively. If we all take a glass of ice outside on a hot summer day, what happens? The ice melts. And so when you see those pictures of melting glaciers around the world, people intuitively understand, oh, okay, it's happening, it's warming. But there's a problem with it too. And that is that very, very few of the people who just had that image of melting ice come to their mind live on the shores of the Arctic Ocean, live on Antarctica, or live next to a melting glacier. So what it also does is it reinforces the sense that this is distant. It's ice melting. There's no people in that picture. Or even if there are, they tend to be Inuit Eskimos, and that's not, you know, what most people identify with. So unfortunately, it reinforces the sense that this is happening far away at the poles or high in altitude, not where we live. So that's one of the images that comes most readily to mind, has some utility, but in the end, we have to get beyond that to recognizing that this has real implications for us where we live.
Yeah, I totally agree with that, Tony. And one of the things we've tried to do in the films is to make climate change local. So, for instance, with the movie Dreaming in Green, where the four girls who do the energy audit and save their school $53,000, you know, that begins with their concern about climate change, where they're saying, of all the coastal cities in the world, Miami will suffer the greatest economic loss. And they're concerned about that, and that's what motivates them. And it's interesting because it's not – it might be seemed really scary, but I think that just the fact that it was a focus of money. And so one of the other things that we do with the films is we realize that Americans are very concerned about money. Maybe they worship money, some of them. And so we focus on saving money. You know, with the films is, you know, a lot of them are they're saving CO2, but they're also saving money. So I wondered, do any of your studies actually focus on people's concern with the economic effects of climate change?
Certainly. I think mostly, though, this is a poor framing that the climate community has unfortunately done, is that the conversation has been dominated by the costs of action. Even though in most cases the actions that we need to take are actually going to be profitable. I mean, and I highly encourage your audience to go watch that video that she just mentioned, Dreaming in Green. These four girls are incredible, and they're so inspiring to watch. And they saved their school thousands of dollars, cash-strapped schools. So, I mean, there are lots of things we can do that ultimately are profitable. But much of the rest of the discourse, especially from those who are critical of climate change as a problem, tend to say wildly, this is going to destroy the economy, it's going to harm jobs, and so on.
I want to go back for one second to the question of what photographs or what imagery can do, because all of this is very complex. It's a nuanced issue. We've been talking about risk, but also deeply held values and the costs of things. It's very hard to include or balance all of those things in one image. You know, you could show a picture of a power plant belching smoke that looks very ugly and tells you something about the causes of climate change, or you can show a beautiful picture of a landscape that you value and want to save, but it's hard to get all of that into one picture. So how valuable, you know, we often say a picture is worth a thousand words. How valuable is imagery in trying to convey climate change?
Well, I think imagery is hugely important, as is, frankly, film. Film is one of the most powerful forms of cultural expression and communication human beings have yet developed. And we have seen – we've actually done studies looking at the impact of different films on American consciousness and reaction to climate change. And they're very big. They're huge because they provide us with these visceral, vicarious experiences. And so let's bring it back to – you know, what are the images that are increasingly being associated now with climate change? And that is extreme weather and natural disasters. So we see this in our data that about 6 in 10 Americans think that global warming is already affecting weather in the United States. Moreover, 80% of Americans say that they have personally experienced one or more natural disasters in the past 2 years, and a third of them say they've been personally harmed by them. And even if you didn't live in New York or Connecticut or Massachusetts during Hurricane Sandy and thus didn't directly experience it, nonetheless, you vicariously experienced it because of our media, because we heard and saw those incredible images of the water sweeping ashore, filling the subways, filling the streets, And likewise, the most recent images that we just saw of these incredible record-setting floods in Colorado. And we hear the stories of the people who are being impacted by these events. And many Americans are increasingly now connecting the dots between these kinds of extremes and the way that we're juicing the climate system that's going to produce more and more of these kinds of severe events in the future.
That's Dr. Anthony Lisarowitz of Yale University. I'm also talking with environmental author and producer Lynn Cherry. We'll talk more after a short break.
On the next Fresh Air, we explore the breathtaking dimensions of the Lance Armstrong doping scandal, a network of conspirators, group blood transfusions on the team bus, and extensive efforts to silence and intimidate those who might expose the abuse. We'll speak with Reed Albergati and Vanessa O'Connell about their new book, Wheel Men. Join us.
And you can hear Fresh Air weekday afternoons at 1 and evenings at 10 here on WCAI.
Albert Gaines of Falmouth.
You know, it's a hand-operated, small wooden apple press. They all work the same basic way. The first stage is to grind the apples into a mash, and that's what those kids are doing, turning the crank. And then the mash is thrown into a cylinder with slats on the side. The second stage is to put a circular piece of wood on top of the cylinder, and then you turn the screw that presses it down. You end up with basically pressing the juice out of the mash.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations.
This is Living Lab. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guests are Dr. Anthony Lisarowitz, director of the Yale Project on Climate Change, and author and producer Lynn Cherry. We've talked a little bit about the idea that children can speak to a broad audience. And one thing that has been coming out of some of the social science research in recent years is this idea that if you want to try to appeal to groups of people with different deeply held values, different cultural values that are perceiving this problem in different ways, one of the best ways to do that is to find somebody with those same deeply held beliefs, but who happens to, go along with be convinced of climate change and have some ideas for some solutions. Can children essentially cross some of those boundaries and be trusted messengers for everybody?
Yes, because one of the most deeply held beliefs of everyone is that you care for your children. You take care of your children and you love your children and you protect them. And these children are all asking their parents to please protect the world, protect their future, and show that they care for them. And this is really highlighted by when I show the films, that especially Plant for the Planet, which is an 11-year-old boy from Germany who is planting millions of trees to take up CO2, grown men come up to me after that screening with tears streaming down their face. So I know it's really getting to their hearts.
How important, Anthony Lisarowitz, is it to get to people's hearts as opposed to just getting to our brains about this issue?
Oh, well, it's crucial. I mean, you know, human beings have, loosely speaking, two very different processing systems operating at the same time in our heads. One is this analytic system that's rational. It's logical. It's slow. It's deliberate. Science itself is one of the preeminent expressions of it. But at the same time, we have this other system that we loosely call the experiential system. That's the home of these associations and images and feelings and deep emotions. It's where our values and narratives often lie. And in fact, both of these are constantly operating within us at this exact same time. And in fact, what we're finding through neuropsychology is that, in fact, you can't make rational decisions without input from the emotional centers telling you that this is a better option versus that. So our values turn out to be critically important. And I want to come back, however, to just another example of how sometimes those values can align in ways that surprise us. Because this is the art of politics, is finding strange bedfellows, people who may agree and support the exact same policy, albeit for completely different reasons. And the best example of that recently is down in Georgia, where the Tea Party joined forces with the Sierra Club to fight the monopoly electric utility that was fighting to maintain its sole ability to be a producer of energy. The Tea Party and the Sierra Club, on the other hand, wanted to open up the regulations so every household could put solar panels on their roof and sell their electricity back into the grid. Obviously, the monopoly didn't want that. So they joined forces, okay? And they actually won. They actually defeated the monopoly and opened up that market. Now, you know, that's remarkable. Again, the Tea Party and the Sierra Club, and they actually are now calling themselves, if you'll wait for it, the Green Tea Party.
Okay.
So, and yet they totally disagree about other things. So the Tea Party says, well, we should build more nuclear power plants. And guess what? The Sierra Club's pretty much opposed to that. So they don't agree suddenly about everything. But they did find common cause around that. And I think that's one of the things we need to be looking for. We need to be asking our politicians to do is to find areas of common ground where we can, in fact, bring very diverse values together in pursuit of common goals.
Well, and to that point, there was a study here in Massachusetts a couple of years ago. Mass Inc. Polling Group did something kind of similar, actually, to Six Americas. They only divided Massachusetts' population into four groups instead of six. But they found that the group that was most dismissive of climate change tended to be more on the conservative political spectrum, but they also tended to be at least as likely as the people most alarmed or concerned about climate change to be doing things like conserving electricity and reducing their energy footprint, but probably coming at it from the perspective of trying to reduce their household costs as opposed to trying to reduce their carbon footprint. And so, Lynn Cherry, that's back to your point about how sometimes the win-win solutions and money aligning with carbon footprint.
Well, also, National Wildlife Federation has created a relationship with anglers associations because the anglers have been – fishermen have been realizing that their fish are suffering because of the warming temperatures, like trout in trout streams. And so now that they're both working together to do something about climate change.
Yeah, and I would just say we see the exact same thing in our national data, that people who are dismissive of climate change are often conserving energy at the same rate as people who are alarmed about climate change. But again, they're doing it for different reasons. First, it's just an inherent conservatism that thou shouldn't waste. Okay, this is about wasting energy as well as wasting money. But we also see, again, that they have great support for clean energy, as an example, not because they care about climate change, but because it resonates with their values of independence, of freedom, and of that greatest American value born right here in New England of self-reliance, that we want to be able to produce and control our own energy future. And so many of them do support things like, again, rooftop solar. As somebody who lost power several times in the hurricanes, I desperately wish I could have produced my own darn energy instead of being reliant on a grid that would go down all over the place. Mm-hmm. So I think there are these opportunities. And one last example are of another value that gets brought to bear is moral and religious values. We're seeing an incredible movement within the religious community. The greening of religion is happening right now. We actually just did a study on evangelicals. The stereotype is that evangelicals are anti-science, they're anti-climate, and so on. It turns out not to be true. Half of evangelicals do accept that climate change is happening and a serious problem, and in fact support action. And they come at it through their own values, not just the science, but their values. Either the concern about creation care, that when you read Genesis, God very clearly says your job is to till and tend the garden, and their argument would be we're not doing a very good job of that. Or even more importantly, the admonition by Jesus to take care of the sick and the weak and the poor, those the least among us. And these are institutions that have devoted millions of dollars, send their kids across to other countries to help them pull people out of poverty. So their argument would be, how can we in good conscience ignore a problem that's going to push millions more people into the exact kind of destitute circumstances that we're trying to help them out with?
But of course,
again,
people
can come from different perspectives.
Well, I'll say, but talking about the different perspectives, there's a flip side to that, which is there are other evangelical religious groups who say, Genesis tells us to till and tend the garden, which means that we have the right to do whatever we want with the planet. And in terms of taking care of the poor, we should be creating jobs, not taking away jobs. And so they're using those same values to argue a completely different set of actions and a completely different agenda. If we were to stick more to the science of climate change, do you think that it would be harder to argue those two different angles than if you come at it purely from the values perspective?
No, that implies that somehow science exists in a vacuum. And science ultimately provides facts. It can inform our decisions. But in the end, the decisions are going to be made by taking the best information we can get and mixing that with our values. Ultimately, it's the values of our society that are going to determine how we respond to climate change. So, I mean, I don't think there's any way to separate them in the end. And so what you're pointing to is that we have difference of interpretation over some of the same facts because we often have different interpretations of our values.
Now, Lynn, we often get a lot of our values from our parents. At least that's where we think we're getting most of our values, right? Children get their values from their parents. But you were also talking earlier about this burgeoning awareness of your own power and exploring your own view of the world. And in fact, the facts, I would say, that children are getting are very different than the facts that we got when we were in school. So how does that intersection between facts and values play out for kids in this situation?
I think I can best demonstrate it by just describing this movie, Olivia's Birds and the Oil Spill, because when the oil spill occurs, Olivia actually has some really beautiful relationships with a great blue heron and a pelican that are on the Gulf Coast where her grandparents live, and she's just in tears when she sees that oil spill, the BP oil spill. And there's a scene where she and her family are all holding hands and they're praying. And so she comes from a place of faith, but also a place of the feeling the sanctity of nature and really just deeply, a deep love and reverence for nature. And she wants to do something, so she writes to Audubon and asks, can she donate some artwork? And they put it up on their website. It goes viral, and she raises $200,000 to clean off the oiled birds in the Gulf. And then she goes and she lobbies her congresspeople about renewable energy. So it sort of brings all these things together that we're talking about. And I think that's the power of film or art, you know, that you can take the science and you can take the art and the values, and you can blend them together in a way that they are appealing to pretty much everyone.
Now, Anthony Lacerowicz, climate change is not the only area where we have these discrepancies between scientific consensus and what the American public thinks about them. Evolution is another one that springs to mind immediately, but there are a number of examples where this phenomenon of cultural cognition and the intersection of values and how we perceive facts have been studied. So can you give us some examples of what some of the other areas where we see this kind of issue arise, and what is it that makes for, I guess, problematic science?
Well, I want to take your question and change it just slightly because I want to situate it in today's conflict. And that is that while these deep value conflicts are absolutely going on, they've also gotten infused into our politics. And so we haven't even talked about this, but I think it's kind of critical. And that is that this issue has become increasingly a source of division between Democrats and Republicans. And in fact, it wasn't always this way. In 1997, Democrats and Republicans were really not very far apart on the issue of climate change. But since that moment, the two parties have gotten farther and farther and farther and farther apart. I mean, and just most recently, remember that as late ago as 2008, just a few years, the presidential nominee by the Republican Party was John McCain, who for years had been the principal architect and champion of climate change legislation in the U.S. Congress. 4 years later, everyone running for president on the Republican side, with the sole exception of John Huntsman, either said that climate change was a hoax or not real or not a serious problem. So we've seen that one of the parties has really shifted their basic reaction and response to this issue. And unfortunately, that has really changed the way Americans think about it, because they increasingly think of it as this political partisan issue, which to the scientific community makes us kind of tear our hair out. Because in the end, the climate system does not care whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. It's not like Sandy only destroyed the homes of Democrats and not Republicans. It's not like the wildfires out west only take out the homes of liberals and not conservatives. This is an issue that is affecting and going to affect all of us. And in the end, we have to come together across party lines to develop the real solutions that are going to be required.
We just have a couple minutes left here, Anthony, but I want to ask you, why is this such an issue in the United States and not an issue that we really see as much elsewhere in the world? I don't think we see the same discrepancy between scientific consensus and public opinion, say, in Europe. Why not?
Yeah, great question. So we study this around the world in about 130 plus countries. And what we see is that there's really only four countries where this debate, if I can call it that, over the reality of climate change is even taking place. That's the United States, in Canada, in Australia, and in the UK. That's it. You don't find this kind of debate pretty much anywhere else. Not in China, not in India, not in Central South America, not in Africa. And what's interesting about those four countries is that they're all English-speaking, with the exception of the UK, which was the source for the colonization of the other three. They were all frontier societies where this ideology, this value system of rugged individualism, of being completely independent and on your own, is a core part of national identity. And I don't think that's an accident because, again, it's that extreme view of individualism that we should be completely autonomous and not responsible to the broader society. It's that viewpoint that is the most critical of climate change. And really, that kind of debate, if we can call it, that over the reality of climate change is limited to those four countries.
Lynn, one last closing thought here.
How much of that is also caused by the obfuscation campaigns by the oil and gas industry in those countries?
A question for another day. Anthony Lucerowitz and Lynn Cherry, thank you both.
Thanks, Heather.
Thank you.
Dr. Anthony Lucerowitz is a research scientist and director of the Yale Project on Climate Change at the School of Forestry and Environmental Studies at Yale University. Lynn Cherry is a renowned children's book author and illustrator and founder of Young Voices for the Planet, a series of short videos highlighting kids who've taken action to address climate change. Lynn will be at the 9th annual Connecting for Change conference taking place this weekend in New Bedford. You can find a link to more information about the conference on our website. We've also posted one of the Young Voices videos and a selection of Anthony Lucerowitz's nature photographs. You'll find it all at capeandislands.org. Click on Living Lab in the program menu. Until next week, this is Living Lab on the Point. You can find Living Lab all week on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab on the Point is produced by Heather Goldstone, with assistance from Jenny Junker and Alicia Orsini. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Major support for Living Lab is provided by the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment. Additional support from Michael and Roxanne Zach. Living Lab is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.